A brief meeting to decide on the first pioneer had quickly settled on her, once Max Ward had suggested her name. "So what if it's Max's idea?" Nicola had murmured to Jophiel. "She might be one of his acolytes right now, but so are half the young people on this ship. She's young, she's smart, she's a leader, and she represents the future of mankind, whatever that turns out to be. Who else but her? Max is one of those incredibly dumb people who sometimes make an incredibly smart decision almost by accident." Jophiel was impressed that Cinello's first words were not some gushy reaction, but were calm, efficient, factual, precise. "The gravity feels normal. Of course, just as inside the life dome. Hull plate is almost perfectly smooth and frictionless. But the Kara pads on my boot seem to work well. Just think. I'm using stuff for moving around on Chile hull plate that was first developed when Michael Poole and Jack Grant explored the cache." "That should have been me," Nicola muttered.
"Let it go," Jophiel whispered.
"It feels a little sticky when I walk. I have to pick up my feet deliberately. Sooner that than I fall on my butt and everybody laughs."
"And there's the 16-year-old, Jophiel murmured.
Several paces away from the life dome now, Cinello looked around, lifted her head. "The view out here is... I won't try to describe it. You can feel how big everything is. Those strange glows to east and west. That roadway in the sky, the upper deck, like it might fall down and crush me. It's all too big. Maybe we'll get used to it with time. I'm only a short walk away, but the life dome looks small already, fragile. But it's all we've got. We should take care of it, like Mr. Poole says." It occurred to Jophiel that Cinello and the other youngsters, who hadn't even been to Goober Star, must have a profoundly deprived sense of distance, of scale. In the life dome, in interstellar space, everything in the universe had been either no more than a few hundred meters away or at infinity. He wondered if that would help or hinder them as they tried to learn their way around the wheel. "I think I should get the flags out now." She opened her pack. She drew out a couple of fold-out poles with Kara pad bases that she stuck to the hull plate floor. Then she shook out two flags and fixed them to the poles. One was the ancient UN standard, a laurel wreath cradling the earth against a blue background. The second was the flag of Mars, a bright red globe cut across by non-existent canals. Michael murmured, "She asked for the flags herself."
"I know," Nicola said. 16 years old and she looks back to the past. Smart kid."
Cinello had the flag set now. She put down her pack and stepped back and looked around, at the sky, the wheel floor, the life dome.
"I know this is a big moment. The kind that only happened a few times before in human history, or prehistory. The first time people walked on new continents, on Earth, like the first Australians. Or when the astronauts first walked on the moon, the first human footsteps on another world. The first on Mars. And then the first footsteps on the Chile cache, when humans came into contact with an alien artifact, a craft from beyond the stars for the first time. Armstrong on the moon said he came in peace for all mankind. Grant on the cache said the same thing. I think he meant it, even if it didn't work out that way. Because for sure the Chile hadn't come in peace. Now we've come all the way out here. Everybody thinks we came to fight, that we came for revenge against the Chile that wrecked the Earth. We are following Michael Poole, who inspired a great galactic war against the Chile in a different timeline. But I was born on the Cauchy. I never saw Earth, and I know about relativity. Every time I take a breath here, a whole month goes by in the universe outside. The past is gone. Earth is gone. Even Cauchy is gone. I'm not going to claim we came in peace. We did come here for all mankind, I think. I believe we came to understand, above all. But if that means war, so be it.
She paused.
That's all I want to say.
She turned and Jophiel could see her grin, wide behind her faceplate.
So, do you guys want to come out now? It's pretty amazing.
Chapter 45. It was on the following day, the 11th since the crash, that Jophiel and Nicola finally got out of the life dome themselves and walked on the surface of the wheel. Asher was their guide. She seemed in a hurry from the beginning. She walked briskly, directly away from the life dome, and Jophiel and Nicola hurried to keep up. Nicola wore a new armoured skin suit of her own. A design had been guesswork by Nicola herself, Harris and others, as nobody quite knew how much her ghost hide would protect her under the galaxy core sky of the wheel. Nicola muttered as they walked, "So, why isn't Poole himself out here?" Asher said, "He should be. The engineering checks are taking up too much of his attention, too much time."
Jophiel nodded. "It's an occupational hazard if you're a Poole. But I take your point."
"Do you?"
Asher asked, sounding surprisingly bitter.
"Do you really? Do you really grasp what we're facing here?"
"We're out here now," Nicola said seriously.
"We're listening."
Asher drew to a halt, panting.
"Just as long as you do."
She spread her arms and lifted her heavily protected face to the complicated sky.
"Look. Away from the human clutter, the life dome, take a few breaths to just look."
Jophiel followed her advice. He turned at random to the east, as they called it, the direction of spin, where the sky glowed a rich blue. Nicola, too, was looking that way. Jophiel saw that the front of her silvered body reflected blue highlights from the complex sky ahead of her, and her back was painted red by the western sky. Asher was agitated, one gloved hand pulling at the other.
"Nearly 14,000 years pass with every single day we spend here. Time dilation. That kid Cinello got it right from the beginning. Every breath takes a month," she said. "Are none of you thinking about what that means? We are, my team and I, and we've been watching the sky when we've been able to steal time away from Michael Poole's program of chores. I've told him what we've seen, but he doesn't want to disturb the crew while..."
"Just tell us now,"
Nicola said softly.
"Very well. Look, we're going through a new phase now. When events come thick and fast, faster than we are programmed to deal with. One example."
She pointed at the sky, in a direction meaningless to Jophiel.
"Up there. Globular cluster M15. On our fifth day here, suddenly it turned green. The stars, everyone, all at once, in our accelerated frame."
Nicola was baffled.
"M15? So what?"
But Jophiel understood, and his unreal heart hammered.
"Nicola,
that cluster seen from Earth was in Pegasus.
That was the way the gear went after the mutiny."
Nicola's silver mouth dropped open behind her faceplate.
"Oh.
And if they went out there at light speed, nearly..." "They'd have got there in our second day down here," Asher said. "And at light speed, the evidence of whatever they're up to reached us on day 5.
Nicola looked up.
"So, what are they doing?
Who can know? If they maintained Officer Country and its high-speed processing, they could have become an ancient and powerful culture even before they arrived. And now, well, now they have a whole globular cluster to play with, 100,000 stars. That's not all. Cold Earth, Jophiel. Remember what was to become of that? On the longest of timescales, timescales we are now jumping over. Immediately he got it. Wolf 359. He glanced at Nicola. After the displacement, Cold Earth got flung out of the solar system by its residual orbital velocity, aimed more or less by chance at Wolf 359, a red dwarf star. It would have taken somewhere over 80,000 years to get there. He shook his head, a time that seemed impossibly far in the future. Got there day 5, Asher said bluntly.
Leith.
She held up a hand. And on day 8, we saw it.
Saw what?
We figure they initiated it around AD 100,000, Jophiel. Just about the time we estimated the Chile or its machines would have finished its work in the solar system, reduced it all to dust. Well, that was when Wolf 359 lit up with a beacon. All wavelengths from gravity waves on up, it reached us on day 8 here.
Jophiel frowned. They, whoever they are, whatever they have become on Cold Earth, are broadcasting their presence to the galaxy, then?
Asher grinned, uneasy, awed even, Jophiel thought.
Yes. A signal that can mean only one thing.
They're not hiding, Nicola said. They aren't afraid, not any more. Maybe they're calling the scattered home.
Leith.
She laughed, apparently from sheer wonder.
But, Asher said,
look at it another way. That's all we found. Of humanity, I mean. M15, Wolf 359.
Jophiel nodded slowly.
Right.
Whereas if humans had established some galaxy-spanning super-civilization,
we'd know about it. They'd be here by now.
All we found here, Nicola said, is one shabby life dome in that ghost cup world.
So there's just us, Jophiel said, and we can't expect any help.
Correct. Which is why some of us, Asher said carefully, think we need another solution, another plan, for our long-term survival, I mean.
Jophiel shook his head. Another solution based on what?
Asher pointed to the sky.
The cup worlds. We saw them on the way in. Earth-like habitats, more or less. The chances of survival long-term in such a structure are much greater than in the wreck of the Cauchy. If we can pick the right one, Earth 2 on Deck 2 seems the favourite.
Jophiel frowned.
How would we get there? We can't fly anymore.
Even as he spoke, though, a possible solution to that, at least, occurred to him. Anyway, I suspect Michael will say this is all beside the point. We didn't come here for cup worlds, we came to confront the Chile.
Asher said, but securing our survival needn't compromise that goal, even if it takes a little more time. Jophiel, we need to put all this together and to come up with a strategy, and we need to do it fast, because...
I know. 14,000 years per day.
The stars are dying, Jophiel. We're running out of time, literally.
He nodded. You're right. We need to take this to Michael.
Chapter 46. The earthquake hit
4 days later. That was what it felt like, a deep shuddering in the bones of the ground. Jophiel felt it, of course. His space-going instincts had him reach for a skin suit. If a ship's drive faltered or some object hit the hull, the first priority was protection from the vacuum. Then a deeper planet-bound reaction cut in. Earthquake. He felt a profound, irrational fear at this betrayal by the ground itself, the substrate of the world. Then it occurred to him that he wasn't on a planet at all. It took Asher 24 hours to come up with an explanation. "Some kind of impact, we think," she told the seniors. "On the wheel itself. We don't know enough about the wheel's dynamic modes to figure out what struck or where." "Something big, then," Michael Poole said sternly. "A rogue planet, even a star. Well, there are plenty of those. This is a dangerous corner of the galaxy." Nicola was sceptical. "We've only been here a few days. How likely is it a rogue star is going to hit in that time?" Asher shook her head. "You're not seeing it right. Time dilation, remember? A day down here corresponds to about 14,000 years outside. One impactor in an interval like that doesn't seem so surprising, does it? As long as we're down on this deck, we're going to have to get used to rare events happening all the time." Poole grunted. "Good summary. Show's over." So Jophiel and the rest went back to work, though Jophiel never felt quite as secure on this mighty construct as he had before. The next day, Michael Poole gathered his seniors at the centre of the Life Dome amphitheatre. Jophiel glanced at their attentive faces, all bathed in the wheel's relativistic glow. Cinello, first to walk on the wheel, was here too, her face open, engaged. "So," Poole said without preamble, "let's sum up. Here we are, on the wheel. We already endured an epic journey of unprecedented proportions to get here. We made it, mostly. A remarkable achievement. But now we have more to do. We have a number of problems." He counted off on his fingers. "One, we're stuck in this busted life dome and it's all we have. It's all we'll ever have if we stay here. And the longer we sit here, the greater the chance of some catastrophic breakdown. The recycling loops are almost perfectly closed, but not quite. We'll run out of something. Or some random piece of debris will fall on us from out of the crowded sky up there. Meanwhile, we may be running out of another resource. Time itself. As Asher pointed out, now that we're stuck in this pit of accelerated space-time. Look, we know there's a kind of universal crisis going on. We know that because of the infestation of dark matter agents. All the sun-like stars are being aged too rapidly. How rapidly? It would have taken the sun about 5 billion years to blow up into its red giant stage. Now it looks like that will happen in just 1 million years. He forced a grin. It sounds a long time. It's not. On this relativistic wheel of ours, on this deck anyhow, we'll go through 5 million years in 12 months. Just 1 year as we experience it on this deck. However, he nodded to Asher, who stood up now. However, we don't have to stay on this deck, she said. We have somewhere else to go. You're talking about the cup worlds, Cinello called up. You all saw them during the flyby of Deck 3. Environments the size of worlds, indeed, and we found at least two, we think, Earth-like enough for us to survive with a minimum of tech support. Though don't hold me to that before we get up there and figure it out. And listen. The cup worlds may help us solve our other problem. If we climb back out of this relativity pit, we'll gain more time. 5 million years out in the universe is just a year down here. But that deck 1 year stretches out to 10,000 years on deck 2, And a million years on Deck 3, you see? We can win living space and living time, too. And better yet, we'll leave the Chile down here in its time pit until we're ready to deal with it.
Chinello frowned.
But when we get to a cup world, what if there's somebody already there?
Max Ward grinned and bunched a fist. We negotiate.
I have a question, though, Nicola said now. The cup worlds, how do we get there?
Michael held up his hand. We have a solution. Trust me on that. We're working on the details, but we do have one more big problem.
Which is...
I know that one, Max Ward said. The Chile. Which is what we came all this way for. Where is it, and how do we get to it?
Poole smiled. Good news. We spotted it, we think. One of Asher's surveys of Deck 1... There were some signatures that don't appear to be replicated elsewhere on the wheel, as far as we can see. Gravity waves, for instance.
Nicola grunted.
And the bad news?
It's light years away. On this deck, but off around the space-contracted curve of the wheel. We came down at random, remember? It could have been worse, but we lucked out.
Nicola said... Tell me you have a way of getting to it.
Oh, you're working on that too, right?
Which is why we need to buy more time and a place to live. And if that's going to be a cup world...
Okay, Poole. What's your brilliant plan to get there?
Poole kept smiling.
We build trucks.
In the end, it was estimated it would take 4 months for, as Nicola put it, the crew of a crashed starship to convert themselves into a children's crusade. 120 days after the landing on Deck 1, a third of their star life year. So they got to work.
Part 5. Think of the story of the race. Our timelines emerged from the oceans, and for millions of years circled the sun with Earth. Then, in a brief, spectacular explosion of causality, the timelines erupted in wild scribbles across the universe. Humanity was everywhere. But now, our possibilities have reduced. Lycerl, circa 5 million AD. Chapter 47. Ship elapsed time since launch. 25 years, 256 days. Earth date, circa 1,796,000 AD. Walk with me, Michael Poole snapped. Jophiel was happy to obey. He rarely got any kind of attention from his template. Nicola and Asher tried to manage the two Poole's fractious relationship, Asher with tact, Nicola with barbed jokes, as if they weren't to be trusted together. Yet, here they were, in their reinforced skin suits, one authentic, one a consistency protocol sham, just one day, 3 watches away from departure time. A milestone that Max Ward, who Poole had appointed a particularly ferocious keeper of the schedule for this phase of the mission, insisted was not going to be missed by anybody. Walking out together, away from the couchy life dome and towards the trucks of the convoy, around which, even now, there was much frantic activity.
Second pair of eyes, Poole muttered as they approached the first truck, the rearmost of the convoy. You know how it is. You remember how it is. On every big project, every big milestone, every irrevocable step.
I know.
You make sure you haven't missed anything.
Nicola has stories of the military flyers of the Anthropocene. They were pilots, not engineers. But they'd do the same for their planes. They'd walk around the birds. They'd kick the tires, Nicola says. Just checking what they could see.
Poole seemed uninterested in the anecdote. But then he might know it already. Jophiel couldn't remember if Nicola had recounted it before his split with Michael or after. A shared past could make small talk tricky. Poole was silent, his stony AS-preserved face expressionless, softly underlit by the reflected glow from the hull plate floor. Michael Poole was 69 years old now, and yet he seemed ageless. Unlike, Jophiel thought, the grey avatar who occasionally visited him, who seemed to be ageing with acceptance and grace. When they reached the trucks, they looked back at the life dome. Already gutted of its essential systems, its smooth hull broken open by gaping gashes, its inner partitions and structures cannibalized, it sat, still almost elegant, almost wistful, on the pale floor of the wheel deck. Jophiel reflected that he would never have guessed that the thing had crash-landed here. This fragile component had kept a lost crew alive, but now it had had to be sacrificed to support the next phase of the crew's strange journey. The best estimate, given by Asher's scratch team of astronomers together with Poole and his engineers, was that they faced a journey of 150 days, subjective, across the wheel to reach Earth 2, the Earth-like cup world up on Deck 2 that was their destination. Not an easy estimate to make, not an easy plan to construct. The Pools had built wormholes amid the moons of Jupiter. Now they were planning to drive across interplanetary distances, and their cargo could not have been more precious, consisting of, for all they knew, the last humans anywhere in this future age. The last, including infants and newborn, and Jophiel thought, that other newborn, the dark matter larva in its hull plate pod, stolen from the ghosts at Guba's Star, which had carefully been stowed in one of the trucks. If that other Michael Poole was correct, that particular orphan could turn out to be the most significant refugee of all. Hence, the convoy. The core of it were the trucks themselves, hastily improvised. Their hulls had mostly been inner buildings, dismounted from the interior of the life dome and hauled out here, set in a rough line, and equipped with gut engines and wheelbases. These structures were already robust and had the rudiments of independent internal life support. Before its launch, the Cauchy's original design as an interstellar exploration craft had been heavily reworked to make it resilient in case of damage, even purposeful attack, so these inner buildings were like storm shelters. The wheels, meanwhile, were treated with so-called Kara pad hull plate adhesive. Everybody hoped this feature wouldn't be necessary. After all, the simple spin gravity of this astounding artifact kept everything it carried stuck to its inner surface. But the Pools couldn't be sure of that. After all, to reach Deck 2, they were going to have to climb. They had no space-capable flitters. All had been mounted in the gutship spine or docked to the base of the life dome, and had been lost when the dome had been severed from the rest of the ship. They did have one atmospheric-capable craft, a flyer, taken apart, and to be carried as components within the convoy until needed. But Jophiel, like Poole, was anguished that they had lost all their space-going capability. Anyhow, the two of them walked around the convoy, checked what they could, softly spoke to people labouring to meet their deadlines. They even lent a hand with loading stuff. Everybody knew it was symbolic, nothing more. Just a day out from departure, all the decisions had been made, all the work that could be reasonably be done had been finished. They were committed. One more sleep. Then they began. Chapter 48. Ship elapsed time since launch. 25 years, 257 days. Every step of the way was planned. The trucks rumbled slowly forward, at no more than walking pace at first, with skin-suited observers outside watching soft screens with diagnostic data. The convoy stopped after an hour with only a few kilometres covered, and the rest of the watch was spent checking over the vehicles and fixing minor flaws. An unbalanced axle, one gut engine running slightly out of true, an odd smell in one of the habitable compartments that turned out to be the result of a clogged algae filter. The life dome was still easily visible, a broken bubble on the flat, infinite horizon. At the restart, there was a changeover of crew. Now Poole ordered that the vehicles be run up to their operating speed, at 500 kilometres an hour. The engineers were confident of the capacity of the gut engines, heavily screened against Quagma Phantoms, to handle the job. It was the much more primitive mechanics of the improvised wheels and axles and transmission linkages and gears, all hastily adapted from other uses or manufactured with matter printers, that concerned Poole and his team. So, after half a watch's running, a mere 2,000 kilometres covered, Poole ordered another halt, another half watch of inspections, repairs, replacements. On the third watch, at last, Poole allowed a running of a full 8 hours at the nominal speed. After that, the expedition settled into a rhythm of two watches on, one watch off each day. Soon they were making a respectable 8,000 kilometres a day, about a fifth of the Earth's circumference every day, Jophiel reminded himself, an epic journey in the context of most of humanity's history, but a baby's footstep on the wheel. After a couple of days there was grumbling about that two-on, one-off pattern, with a whole watch being wasted every day. The vehicles ran with impressive efficiency, and there was rarely a repair or maintenance task that could not be accomplished in motion. But it wasn't just the machinery that needed a break from the endless travelling. Soon, even Jophiel found himself counting down to the end of another 16-hour stretch in confinement, after which the trucks would be drawn up in a rough circle, and people would pour out of the airlocks in their skin suits to walk, run, exercise, even play some sport. The children, predictably, made the most of the breaks, with some of the older ones using their hours of freedom to dash away as far as they could get towards an illusory horizon. Their parents groused that it was just as well that on this tabletop of a surface it was impossible for them to get out of sight. Conversely, there were some people who seemed reluctant to leave their cosy interior environments if they got too immersed in some project, a study, a hobby, work, a game, a relationship. Poole put Max Ward in charge of making sure that everybody got out of the vehicles at least once a day. Even Susan Chen walked daily. Often she was accompanied by Nicola, two victims of Goober's Star, Jophiel thought, and they made an odd couple, the small, bent, old woman, the awkward, silver-plated statue. But Harris Kemp said they were good for each other, that Susan was slowly talking her way out of the profound shock of the final revelation of the ghost's manipulative kindness, their preservation of the illusion of her crewmate's descendants.
"Walking and talking," Harris said. "Best therapy we've got for both of them."
So the crew settled into a routine. They travelled on and on. And, as Jophiel never forgot, for every day they travelled, nearly 14,000 more years shivered by in the universe beyond the wheel. The crew had declared the wheel's spinward direction as east, which in turn determined north, west and south. In those terms, the Cauchy had landed 160,000 kilometres south of the centre line of Deck 1, about a sixth of the deck's width away from that axis. And so the convoy now headed steadily north, seeking the centre. They travelled over a featureless, edgeless plain,
But with the mighty slash of Deck 2 running across the sky above their heads, and the great relativistic washes of light, blue and red to east and west, at least it was possible to lose their way, Jophiel thought dryly. At this rate of travel, including the one watch stops, it ought to take the convoy some 20 days to reach the center axis. On the 19th day, they reached the river. They made an unscheduled stop. Poole left Max Ward in command of the convoy and led a party forward to investigate, Jophiel, Nicola, Asher, Chinello. Asher and her colleagues had long known of the existence of the centerline hull plate river, in theory. It was part of the grand networked flow of hull plate around the structure of the wheel. Their whole strategy for the trip, the whole of their future lives, depended on them being able to understand this latest phenomenon, understand and safely exploit. But they didn't even know how wide it was. It hadn't been clear exactly when they would come to what Jophiel supposed they had to call its bank. So now, Poole and his companions confronted utter strangeness, standing in a line looking north, facing nothing. "I can't even see it," Chinello complained. She took a tentative step forward, tapped the surface with her toe, flinched back, set down her foot firmly, pulled it back. "Can't feel anything strange." Asher said, "But it's there. Look, Chinello, here's a neutrino scan." Chinello looked into the soft screen, and Jophiel looked over her shoulder. To his right, to the east, the river glowed a subtle blue, a blue that intensified the further north he looked, and to the west, a redness, a pink, fading to crimson. Chinello had grown up with this kind of symbolism. Blue shift and red shift. She stared at the floor. "It's flowing, from east to west, even though you can't see a bank." "No discontinuity," Poole said. "Just a smooth transition. And it's actually a double stream, two rivers side by side, each 10,000 kilometers across. One flowing west, like this one, its partner flowing east. Each one is stationary at the bank and at the interface between the streams. At their center lines, they flow the fastest. We actually know how fast. In their center lines, you're looking at 6% of light speed." Chinello goggled. "That fast?" "It's a big structure," Jophiel said gently. "It doesn't look like it's going at 6% of light speed," Chinello said. Cautiously, she probed again with her booted toe. Asher said, "There's room for a gradient. If the speed of this moving roadway built up steadily towards the center, which it probably doesn't, step in 1 meter and you'd be moving at about walking pace. Another meter, double that."
"Leith.
So what now?" Nicola laughed. "Now we're going to ride this river." Chinello just stared. Michael Poole looked around at the engineered sky, the ground, and pointed upwards. "Chinello, we don't have a lot of choice. I'm trying to get us up to a cup world up there on deck 2. And we're going the long way round." Now he pointed west. "That way is the nearest strut, a connection between deck 1 and deck 2, a vertical shaft. It's about 2.5 light days away. That's not much on the scale of the wheel, only about 1/1000th of the circumference, if the wheel was stationary. But it's pretty far in our terms. 2.5 light days out from Earth would have delivered you to the Oort cloud, and that's the nearest strut. The next nearest to the east, well, don't worry about that."
2.5 light days, Chinello said, frowning.
"But if we can ride the river at 6% of light speed, that will take us, about 40 days?
Near enough,
Well, that's the plan. The whole point of the flow system is to deliver new hull plate around the wheel as seamlessly and painlessly as possible. All we have to do is hitch a ride. But that's probably the easy part. When we get to the strut, we'll need to climb it. Luckily for us, there's a river flowing up the strut, just as it flows along the deck, though the speed seems to be a lot slower. The distance up to deck two is only about a light minute, but we think it might take us 10 days to climb that high. Cinello frowned. Going straight up? But we can't drive that way. It would be like driving up a wall. Jophiel grinned. Don't worry. If we get that far, we'll think of something. Okay, Poole said now. He pointed up at the line of deck two above their heads. So, we hitch a ride up the strut, and then we'll have to ride the river that runs along that deck all the way to the Cup World, which is 1,000 astronomical units, more than 5 light days to the east of us.
And then?
Nicola smiled. The Cup World. More footprints and flags. Cinello seemed to think the whole thing through. Then she said,
I'll believe it when I see it.
At first, at least, the plan unfolded pretty much as intended. It was on the 19th day of the expedition that they had found the river. They spent a day on cautious experimenting, mapping and measuring. It turned out the river's speed gradient was smooth but not simple. There were stretches of relative stillness swept along by the wider flow, like huge, invisible rafts. Driving a truck over the river itself was tricky, as that differential flow caused the wheels to slew. But you could park up in comfort on a raft and just ride. The feature was so useful that Asher speculated it was designed this way, that the rivers had a secondary function for the Chile itself as a crude cargo transport system. When they were satisfied, the convoy trundled forward. It took another day or so to reach a raft close to the river's centerline. That generous 6% light speed was not enough to create any relativistic effects visible to the unaided senses. Indeed, even at this speed, the wheel was so gross in its large scale, so featureless on the small scale, that there was no real sense of motion at all. That was until the strut became visible, a wall itself 20,000 miles wide, plummeting into view. 41 days after reaching the river, they approached the strut base. They drove off the river. The strut was a wall that reached from ground to sky, from horizon to horizon. More exploration proved there was indeed another hull plate stream flowing up the face of the strut surface. And another day of cautious experimenting proved that getting a ride along the strut, straight up into the sky, would be easier than they had feared. Here it turned out, the Chile had used its inertia control technology. Somehow the tug of spin gravity was overcome, and a sense of gravity with down pointing into the strut wall was established. Once the convoy was on the strut, the vehicles could simply ride the upflowing central river as easily as they had followed the deck's own central flow. Getting a vehicle onto the strut was a challenge, though. There seemed no obvious transitional equipment, no ramps or slings. In the end, cautious experiments, made by skin-suited people just walking in, showed that the inertial control system seemed to incorporate a kind of invisible ramp. If you walked forward, you were lifted up, through a smooth right-angle curve, until your feet hit the strut face. And there you were, standing at right angles to your crewmates. So to get aboard the strut in a truck, you had to just drive forward and hope. It was an interesting experience, Jophiel discovered when he tried it. It took 2 more days of trial and experiment before the convoy had been transferred to the strut.
Then 10 more days to sit tight and allow the convoy to be borne up the strut or across it. To the senses, the strut now felt like a bridge between the upended decks, between 2 vertical walls, walls that spanned the sky. The architecture of heaven, Nicola said. On the expedition's 17th day, however, over halfway along the strut, they rode through an earthquake. That was how it felt to Jophiel, who had been trying to get some sleep at the time. The truck he rode jolted, shuddered, rose a little, before settling back on its suspension. Just like before. With the truck still travelling, Michael Poole called a conference, where they made observations, compared notes, and debated the matter. The best idea anybody had was that once again a rogue star, falling out of a galaxy centre sky full of rogue stars, had got through whatever defences the Chile had set up and slammed into the wheel, into a strut or a deck. Back in the solar system, Michael Poole had once crashed a gut ship into a Chile artifact, and later a whole minor moon had been hurled at the Chile sycamore seed ship itself. Neither had shown the slightest deflection. It was as if, Highsmith Marston had speculated, Chile technology was anchored to space-time itself. Evidently that anchoring had limits. "Hits it hard enough," Poole concluded bleakly, "and this thing would ring like a tuning fork." Asher logged the event carefully. This impact had happened 70 days into their odyssey by truck. As they rose up the strut, they had very quickly climbed out of the deep time pit, but even so, Asher ascribed the event an astounding external date of 2,710,000 AD. Whereas the first impact they'd experienced had happened at around 220,000 AD. Jophiel was flummoxed. He hadn't tracked the cosmic dates so carefully. They were approaching 3 million years since cold Earth. And here was galaxy core weather, raining stars. He had trouble sleeping. On the 74th day, they reached the terminus of the strut. They passed through a peculiarly conventional-seeming tunnel that led them over another right-angle bent gravity curve to the upper surface of the new deck, Deck 2. Here they spent another interesting day in their transition to the new deck, a fresh hull plate river. From there, another 90 days. And they came to the rim of the cup world. Earth 2, a place glimpsed only in hasty flybys across astronomical distances, and now their best hope of salvation. The convoy drove off the river, the trucks were circled, and a camp quickly established. Then, after a couple of hours, a single truck, dragging a trailer laden with the components of an aircraft, cautiously approached the cup world's edge. Chapter 49. Ship elapsed time since launch, 26 years, 57 days. Earth date circa 2,710,000 AD. The crew emerged from the truck. Jophiel deliberately took a step away from the others and looked around. The sky was heavily distorted by their motion, but much less so than at the extreme of Deck 1. Stars, though blue-shifted and red-shifted, were clearly discernible all around him, above and below this great platform in space. Time dilation was gentler here too. On Deck 2, a subjective day corresponded to a mere 17 months in the outside universe, compared to nearly 14,000 years on Deck 1. Above his head, Deck 3, over 1,000 astronomical units high, was invisible to the naked eye. Behind him, the great flat expanse of Deck 2. Around him, his companions, all in their heavy-duty skin suits, their soles gripping the featureless hull plate floor, Chinello Asher, Nicola, Poole. All looking around with evident curiosity, if not awe. And before them, a captive world, yet another vast feature on a vaster artifact, as if they stood on the other side of the sky. Cautiously they approached the rim of the pit. The texture of the ground itself changed at the edge, Jophiel saw. On this side, under his feet in the vacuum, hull plate. Beneath the lid, what looked convincingly like rock, a kind of granite, Asher had suggested. There was no sense that this was an enclosed pit, no sense of curvature. It was, Jophiel thought, as though he stood at the straight line edge of some tremendous canyon, as though he looked straight down 50-kilometer cliffs to a rust-brown ground where a few splashes of grey-green huddled. Asher had promised there was air down there, with a decent proportion of oxygen and liquid water, and evidently life, though there hadn't been time yet to examine it up close. Directly below him, near the clinging clumps, he could see a dark snake that might be a river. He lifted his head slowly, following the line of the river across an arid plain, as it made for a blue-grey expanse that might be a landlocked sea. Then beyond the sea more mountains, rounded, eroded, beyond the mountains a grey plain, beyond the plain a distant horizon, perfectly flat as far as he could see, with no sense of curvature. This really was a bowl the size of a world. All of this was faintly obscured. He was 50 kilometers high and looking down through an entire atmosphere. He was struck by how few clouds he saw, a few wan layers spread out below him, and he made out a kind of shading of the landscape, as if cast by banks of cloud, a striping alternately bright and dark, though the pattern was complex. It swirled and knotted like flow lines, not cloud shadows, surely. Standing here, he could see there was something separating him, out here in the vacuum in his simulated skin suit, from the apparently living world below, a layer over the sky. It was like a flat, almost transparent lid, stretching over the whole of the pit as far as he could tell. Or if it was like the surface of a very still pond, Jophiel thought now, occasionally visible in elusive reflections. They'd glimpsed this feature on cupworlds from afar, even during the flyby. The cupworlds were covered by some kind of force field, was the best guess so far. It was presumably meant to keep stuff out, such as the unending sleet of galaxy center radiation, rather than keep stuff in. These rock walls were so high that even without this intangible lid, the atmospheric loss from the great puddle of air down there would have been negligible. To go further, they would have to penetrate that shield. Jophiel glanced round at his companions. Chinello stood and stared. Asher grinned widely, as if delighted by all she saw. Poole frowned. There was a kind of impatience about Michael Poole, who, Jophiel suspected, saw all this not as an adventure, but an obstacle, another hurdle to cross. Nicola, in her custom skin suit, seemed puzzled. "Something odd about those oceans," she said now. "And the mountains come to that." Jophiel glanced at her. "Odd." "Odd that they exist at all. This isn't a world, it's a toy. There's nothing underneath it all but hull plate, as far as we know. So what about erosion? There has to be weather down there, and where there's weather, there is erosion. What happens when those mountains wear away and the oceans silt up? On Earth, tectonic cycling. The drifting of the continents, the recycling of material through the crust, would turn all the silt back into mountains."
"There hasn't been the time," Jophiel said. "At this level, Deck 2, while the time dilation is a lot less than down in Deck 1. It was a strange paradox of the wheel's nature, that the higher you climbed onto its structure, rising up from deck one, the younger it was, because the higher decks moved more slowly than the lower and suffered less time dilation. As seen from the external universe, the best part of 3 million years had elapsed since the Chile had come here to build this thing. On deck one, the lowest level, less than a year had elapsed since then, as seen by a witness there. But this second deck was 5,000 years old, and the upper deck, subjectively, was more than 500,000 years old. Such numbers had led to many wild hypotheses among the crew about the sequence in which the wheel had been constructed. Asher put in, "She has a point, though. Even if this cup world is only 5,000 years old, you'd build for the future, wouldn't you? A self-sustaining system." Jophiel shrugged. "Maybe there are repair mechanisms, Asher. We just haven't found them yet." But Asher scowled, and Jophiel knew that expression. She didn't like it when the universe didn't make sense, and she would keep nagging at the detail until it did. Jophiel felt a spark of admiration. Here was a human, dwarfed by her tremendous surroundings, 3 million years out of her time, staying calm, gathering data, interpreting, thinking. "So," Michael Poole said, "we need to go forward. I'm thinking of a planned sequence of tests of that force field barrier, starting with a probe attached to some kind of lanyard." Cinello stared at him. "A lanyard? How long is that going to take? Oh, look." She crumpled up a soft screen and just hurled it at the shield. They were in a vacuum and in close to a full gravity. The screen sailed over like a brick even as it unfolded. It fell and passed through the shield, that elusive meniscus, without any apparent hindrance, and landed flat on the rocky surface beyond. "Ha!" Cinello walked forward and peered down. "There! I can see the screen is working." She tapped at a wrist unit. "Picking up and returning data just fine." Nicola laughed. "Well done, kid. I have a feeling that if this barrier was meant to hurt us, we wouldn't be able to get even this close. But you don't go marching through it yet, Cinello. Let's see if it lets through something as complex as a virtual first." Which meant, Jophiel. "Thanks a lot, Nicola." Cinello scowled. "Not fair." Poole said with the weary tone of an exasperated father, "Let's just get it done, Jophiel." Asher held up her own screen. "Ready?" So Jophiel, virtual heart hammering, stepped forward. The hull plate dipped down slightly so that it passed under the shield surface. Jophiel took one step, two, until his boots were covered by the shining meniscus. "I feel nothing." "It looks like you're standing in a shallow lake," Asher said. "Stepping off the hull plate and onto the rock, I can feel the unevenness. My boot soles are thin enough for that. It's pretty steep, but I think I can walk down it." The shield, all but invisible, rose up across his body. He could feel nothing. When he was immersed, he looked back up at the others standing on the hull plate looking down. "Here I am, as intact as I ever was. I can see you, the stars. So," he struck a pose, "on behalf of all mankind, I name this world..." "Oh, no, you don't!" Cinello came stumbling down the slope after him. They still had some hours of work to get through before moving on. The next step was to carry their flyer down through the lid. Not an easy chore given the quickening steepness of the rocky rim inside the cup world. Once through, they test-fired the craft's fusion engine and other systems. They checked, too, at Poole's insistence, that the flyer could be hauled back out of the pit and would still function. All this procedure was built on earlier, cautious planning, Jophiel knew.